already, so I didn't see nine anymore. Operator error.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board, members of the public and staff. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Mr. Teixeira, for coming. That's very kind. I really appreciate the acknowledgement. My name is Bob Larson. I'm a senior environmental scientist here with the Water Board, and every year we like to come to the board and share with you a status report of our Lake Tahoe TMDL programs, and so that is why I'm here today. I have essentially three, four parts of the presentation. I have about 30 slides for you today. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Lake Tahoe TMDL and where we've been with that program. I know we've talked a lot about that in the past, so I'll do my best to avoid any redundancy there. I'm also going to talk about the municipal MPDS permit update. That is the primary permit that regulates stormwater runoff here in the Tahoe Basin. And then I'll close out by talking about some of the research and monitoring efforts, as well as our agency partnership, which, again, Mr. Teixeira has already hit on a little bit this morning. But those are the major sections of the presentation. Please, if you have any questions, if there's anything that you would like me to expand upon, don't hesitate to interrupt me or ask questions. I will stop in a couple of areas and prod you a little bit, see if you can answer questions. Looking first at the Lake Tahoe TMDL, recall that the Lake Tahoe TMDL is our science-based plan to restore Lake Tahoe's clarity. After about 10 years and $10 million with research, monitoring, modeling, and policy development, this board adopted that plan in 2010. Shortly thereafter, the US EPA approved the plan in 2011. And a lot of that work that we did to evaluate the causes of transparency loss pointed at urban runoff as the primary source of the pollutants impacting clarity. So the implementation plan that we developed does focus on reducing the fine sediment particles and nutrients that are coming from urban runoff discharges, while still supporting and emphasizing the watershed restoration work that goes on in other areas of the basin. It's a long-term plan. We have a long way to go. We've lost a lot of transparency at Lake Tahoe since it was first made in the mid-60s. So the plan for full restoration at this point is 65 years. But we do have a 20-year target to halt Lake Tahoe's clarity decline and start the restoration. And so that is sort of our interim and midterm check. We talked a lot last time we met about the need for an adaptive management system. The Lake Tahoe TMDL program is a long-term effort, and so it's important that we have a formal system to adaptively manage the program. And with consultant support and a lot of time and energy, we developed what we call the Lake Tahoe TMDL management system. Again, we talked a lot about this last time, so I'll avoid kind of going through everything, but recall that there are four major pieces to that effort. Right, it is important for us to consistently and regularly track and report program progress. We also need to gather and evaluate information on a regular basis, and then see if that information is informing the need for any program or policy change, and if so, adopt and implement those changes. And then overlaying all of this is opportunities for stakeholder engagement. We're regularly reaching out to our partners and other folks in the basin to see not only what information they have to share, but also to check in and see what's working, what's not, and how we can improve the process. So the TMDL management system is punctuated by a series of products. I'm going to talk today a little bit about the performance report, again, an important part of the process. There's also a findings and recommendations memorandum that documents what we've learned and what recommendations may have come out of that. But it's also worth noting that we have a stakeholder feedback form and capture sheet. This is available on our website that anybody at any time can provide us direct feedback. We also hold a meeting with Water Board and Nevada Division of Environmental Protection executives on an annual basis to check in. Again, we usually do this after we've evaluated those findings and information, share what we've learned, and share what changes we may or may not be proposing at that time. And if there's important information to share and important decisions to make, we have an opportunity to schedule a stakeholder meeting with those involved parties to get their feedback, share those proposals, and again move forward in a transparent process. And then every year, towards the tail end of the calendar year, we develop what's known as a decision record memo, and that just basically documents the decisions that have been made and any changes or not that have been made. So I just want to touch on a couple of those products. The first, again, the TMDL performance report. It's critical that we have it's a critical part of the adaptive management process for us to regularly and consistently track and report progress for our program. I'm really proud to say that 2015 was the first year that we completed the performance report without consultant support. So that was fantastic to do. I talked a lot last time about the performance metrics and how we're evaluating the the activities that take place in non-urban sources, stream channels, and other areas. So just know that those metrics are continuing to serve us, and they're serving us well, and they help us summarize sort of how things are going. And as with the previous performance report, this performance report in 2015 focused on the non-urban load reduction activities. As I mentioned, we also developed this findings and recommendations memo. This helps us sort of document, first reach out to partners and others, academic agencies, consultants, the whole suite of stakeholders that we can come across, and see if there's any important information that has happened in the last year and how that information might inform the program. And again, this document's where we summarize that information and summarizes the findings and, if appropriate, make any proposed changes to the TMDO program or its policy. So 2015 was a pretty quiet year. Again, we're doing this on an annual basis, and it's undoubtable that we're going to have some years where there's not much going on. And I'm both happy and sad to say that 2015 was one of those years. There's just the program is on track, there's not much going on. When we evaluated the key information that we gathered, again, there was support for the existing programs and policies, and there wasn't any need for dramatic change at this time. 2014 was a banner year for Clarity. We saw the best transparency in over a decade in 2014, and so again, it was good to, obviously that was driven likely by drought conditions and the lack of precipitation that we saw, but nonetheless, we do see those improvements in Clarity were encouraging and supportive of our program. I just want to highlight again that the TMDL effort is a long-term, extended implementation effort. It is going to take some time. I like this graphic just because it puts it on a nice chart, and you can see where we are and where we need to go. Right, we're still there at the bottom. We're approaching this year the first five-year load reduction target there at 2016 of a 10% reduction, and then looking forward towards 2021, that's going to be the next target. So that me in the curve that you see there, 15 years, that's that 20-year implementation target that we have of halting transparency and reducing the decline. There's a lot of good work that has been done and that we're doing in that time, and we expect to see dividends of that within that time frame. And then just extending out, looking forward, I can't wait to continue this program well into my 90s. I updated this chart kind of at the last minute before the board packet went out. I mentioned that 2014 was a banner year. It was. We saw transparency approaching 78 feet, again, the best in a decade. The transparency numbers for 2015 came out just last month, and they found that we lost about 5 feet of transparency in the last year. So while not as good as it was, the five-year rolling average for transparency is still improving. We're still encouraged by the results. But again, I want to highlight we lost about five feet of transparency. And this variation isn't surprising. This is the kind of variation that we see in transparency on a regular basis. And UC Davis researchers suggest that it's likely due to the fact, again, that drought conditions the previous year resulted in less snow, warmer conditions, and so the polluted runoff that did enter the lake was kept from diving deep and likely was kept more towards the surface where it could impact Clarity. So that's sort of the general picture right now with Clarity. But again, we're encouraged with the numbers and where we are in the process right now. I talked about this last time. I want to stress again that we have this fantastic tool, the TMDL online interface. It is all things TMDL, everything I've talked about, the performance report, the findings and recommendation memo, Clarity data, everything that you could possibly want to know about the TMDL can be found on this site. And this continues to serve us as a really nice one-stop shop for our program. It is easy for us to edit. It is easy for us to make announcements. It is easy for us to put the tracking information into it. So it's a really great tool for us that if you haven't checked it out, I encourage you to take a look. It's going to be growing in the next couple of years as we start to get more data. But it is a great place for us to house our performance data and other information. Looking forward at 2016, for the next calendar year, our program plans are pretty simple right now, which is nice. We're going to keep implementing that management system. Again, it works really well. I've heard a lot about adaptive management in my time in the basin and in my time in resource management, and I'm really happy to be involved in an adaptive management process that is really well-defined and has steps along the way that allow us to track progress. It's somewhat tedious, again, in some years where there's not a lot going on, but again, it's a great tool for us, and over the next calendar year, we're going to be essentially implementing that process again. We're already working on the 2016 performance report. We started getting that information together. We're a little behind our date right now, but nonetheless, the information is there, and we're just getting things together to draft that report. And then we're also reaching out to stakeholders, again, paying off everybody and see if there's anything new to learn in the last year so we can start to develop that 2016's findings and recommendations now. One of the more exciting things that's going on in the next calendar year is a project to integrate our data access and information efforts with the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. We have the TMBL online interface. We have our private accounting platform, which is an online tool for tracking the urban improvements and results. And we have recently been awarded some money to integrate that effort with TRPA's larger Lake Tahoe Info System. We've long worked with TRPA and leveraged their program for the Environmental Improvement Program and the associated performance metrics. And this is a great opportunity for us to have kind of some consistent accounting and tracking and reporting across not only across different platforms, but also across programs and policies across the basin. So it's a cool thing, and we're looking forward to that moving forward. And then, of course, ongoing stakeholder engagement. We talk all the time with our partners, and we're going to continue to reach out and make sure that we're hearing what people are saying with respect to the program and trying to respond accordingly. Do you have any questions on the TMBL before I dive into the stormwater permit update?
Mr. Jardine?
No.
Mr. Sandel?
No.
Mr. Dias?
I, of course, have a question.
Can we go back to slide 10?
Of course.
So, looking at this graph and when and the two different slopes on the graph,
yes.
Can you explain a little bit more about the different roles that algae and fine sediment play? And so, how much of the lower slope at the later at the out years is just that more fine sediment is finally settling out of the water column, and how much of that is continued management activities that are improving matters? And then, I mean, last I knew, the whole algae question wasn't that Turk didn't really understand what was driving the finer grain, the smaller sized algae. So what can you update us on that?
Several different parts of your question and elements there, so I'll try to piece them off if I
yeah.
So let me first look at the knee of the curve and try to see if I can answer your question there.
Okay.
And this may be less than satisfying for you, but I'll tell you kind of why there's a knee of the curve there. So when we developed the TMDL implementation plan, we looked closely at what the low production opportunities were for all source categories, what the associated costs were, and went through an extensive process to integrate those things and come up with a plan that made sense, was cost-effective, and focused on where the opportunities were. That plan carried us for the first 15 years, right? Essentially, we didn't plan out detailed implementation actions or evaluate detailed implementation benefits out all the way for the 65 years. So what we saw was there were good opportunities. We were able to quantify and document those opportunities and document that approach for that first 15-year implementation phase. We knew what the load reduction needs are beyond the implementation phase based on UC Davis modeling work. So we knew what the load reductions needed to be. We just don't have as much detailed information about what those load reduction actions will be.
Okay.
Because of that, essentially, we took a straight line. And so it's essentially and that's also acknowledging that we know that it is going to be more difficult, right? We know that load reduction activities are likely to become more challenging to find and perhaps less effective, and we're going to need to start kind of shaking the cushions to figure out where we're going to get particle load reductions when we're out there in the 40 years. So we also acknowledge that 15 to 20 years is a reasonable planning and policy time frame. That's kind of what we focused on. After my retirement, I look forward to, you know, consulting with the folks to develop an implementation plan beyond that. But right now, the implementation plan is looking pretty is out there. The second part of your question, in terms of the relative impact of fine sediment and algae and what's going on with algae in Lake Tahoe, does that understand that correctly? So at the time of the TMDL adoption, and what the researchers told us and what my understanding remains, is that the primary driver of transparency are inorganic fine sediment particles. Right, we're talking about not algae. At any given time, they were saying roughly two-thirds of the clarity condition is driven by the concentration of those particles in the water column. The other piece of that are the algae. And the algae are, as you say, very complex. The species composition, the distribution, the fluctuations, and not only the number, but the type, are really variable. There's a lot going on there, and I think as you referenced, you know, UC Davis has continued to work on this, and there's all, been all sorts of interesting information. I don't know that any of it is necessarily definitive with how those things are affecting clarity. Some interesting information came out last year in terms of how those diatoms and how those different organisms affect the blue color of the lake, which is actually interesting information. But as far as how those things ultimately relate to Lake Tahoe's clarity, we lump them all in the green stuff. They're green particles, it's the algae, and they're less important. That said, they're still in the nutrients that are primarily driving a lot of that. And again, nutrients are expected to be a driver, but you're right. Species composition, a lot of things, a lot of dynamics in the lake are affecting that. But nutrients are a big factor, right? And so that's why the TMDL does continue to focus on nutrient reductions, not only for overall ecological health, but also addressing that piece of clarity equation. Okay?
Yeah. And then, I mean, your line is wonderful, but...
Isn't it?
It is wonderful.
Clear. The stars fall.
But we all need to remember, and I know you know this, that actually the big driver in all this is weather that we do not have control over. So
this is why we don't look at things on an annual basis. You're absolutely right. This is why as fun as it is to say that clarity was that, I mean, we were at our 15 to 20 year target last year. Yay! Fantastic. That's 4 years of drought, right? I mean, we had drought conditions that are really, as you say, the primary driver is the hydrology. And that's why we look at things on a rolling five-year average. You know, again, this winter we saw some normal conditions. Very interesting to see what happens with transparency in 2016. It was interesting to see what happened in transparency last year, despite the fact we had another dry year. We still saw a little bit of a loss in transparency, and again, just goes to show there are a lot of dynamics going on. Who are you thinking I am there?
Those people in the row who are very distracting.
Oh. Would you have anything to add to the conversation? No, seriously, is there anything I'm missing?
Clarifies for Amy. Lori Kemper, for the record. I mean, I just, this chart that we have up on the screen with the straight line, I just want to emphasize it's about the load reduction. You asked a question about is this have anything to do with fine sediment in the lake itself?
Right.
So keep in mind, this chart is sort of a man-made chart. In other words, but I mean, not only did the man make it, but I'm just saying that it reflects control measures we can do as humans related to what we can control in terms of delivery of fine sediment to Lake Tahoe.
I should have looked at the y-axis.
And so it's the fine sediment particle load reduction. I just want to emphasize that for everybody in the room, because the chart about clarity, where Bob discussed the variability, is related more. We have less control over that, you know, because of all the other factors talking about climate. So I wanted to just, you know, I think Bob's point is that we don't know in the future what's available to us to control sediment loads to Lake Tahoe. We're hopeful there'll be new technologies and new ways to improve our ability to control what enters the lake. Yeah, so that I just wanted to emphasize that.
Thanks,
so
Thank you.
Thanks for the
clarification.
Mr. Wexham,
at this point,
okay.
Please continue.
Where was I? Oh, here. Municipal stormwater permit update. I make these slides, there's still snow on the ground, so it all seems timely right now. It's just hot.
It's all relative, exactly.
Things are ephemeral. Times change. The municipal stormwater permit, the first National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Municipal Stormwater Permit was adopted in the Tahoe Basin in 1992. And that permit regulates the runoff discharges from the three urban jurisdictions on the California side of the Lake Tahoe Basin. That's El Dorado County, Placer County, and the city of South Lake Tahoe. It was a pretty exciting permit at that time. Again, that was implementing newly promulgated NPDES regulations that were primarily focused on large jurisdictions at 100,000 or more. We implemented it here in Tahoe due to the sensitivity of the watershed. It made sense. I've been involved with the program for about the last 10 years, and I want to give kudos to our local government partners. We have come a long way in the last decade in terms of how our local government partners consider stormwater, manage stormwater, and are achieving the type of water quality improvements that we want to see. So, again, great work there, and it's great to see. I've also amended my expectations in terms of how quick things happen. So, but it is, again, a lot has happened in the last 10 years, and even the last 5 years, things have come a long way. Our permit includes two primary parts. Those are the Clean Water Act stormwater program elements. These are kind of standard permit elements that are required by the regulation. And then the second part of it is the elements that implement the Lake Tahoe TMDL itself. So let's look first at the program elements. These requirements are what are used to guide our local government partners in implementing comprehensive programs to address stormwater runoff from a variety of different sources. So the sources listed at the top there are construction, industrial, municipal, and commercial. Those programs are all very similar. They require the requirements as local governments to inventory those sites, know where they are on the ground, prioritize those sites with respect to threat to water quality, and then regularly inspect those sites and, if necessary, take enforcement action. It's pretty straightforward stuff, but again, provides a really nice broad blanket programmatic approach for dealing with the potential sediment and nutrient sources, as well as other pollutant sources that come from those, come from construction and municipal and commercial sites. The permit also includes education, outreach, and training components. Again, really important just for them to not only share internally and train internally in terms of the importance of stormwater, but also to reach out externally and interact with the community about the importance of stormwater management and what individuals can do to make sure that stormwater quality is protected in the basin. The program also includes a requirement to evaluate the fiscal needs and, if necessary, try to come up with a plan to acquire resources if shortfalls are identified. And again, this is another area where there's been a lot of work in the last couple of years, and that's pretty exciting. We expressed some concern in the last couple of years that there wasn't enough progress in that area, and in response to that, our local government partners came together and, with some consultant support, developed a partnership to really look at this question and pursue dedicated funding for urban stormwater at a local government level. This is known as the Road to Blue. They came up with a really nice kind of marketing approach, really looking at what the costs are of programs and what the need is, and then looking forward at how best to address that need, what the options might be. And currently, that group is laying the framework for a public polling exercise that will guide decisions about how best to move forward in terms of again, establishing a local government source with dedicated stormwater program right now. Again, this is something that we've talked about. I know this was an issue the last time the permit was adopted. This has been an ongoing conversation, and I'm just happy to see that there are some very concrete steps being taken. And my fingers are crossed that we'll start to see some dividends out of this in the next year or two. So the second part of the permit are the TMDL elements. Again, the Lake Tahoe TMDL, the permit is the primary implementing tool for Lake Tahoe TMDL. The Clean Water Act requires that relevant permits include TMDL requirements, and so as such, the permit that is currently on the books does implement the first five-year load reduction target of a 10% fine sediment particle reduction by 2016. As we've talked a lot about in the past, we have a pretty complicated and detailed system for accounting and tracking known as the Lake Clarity Crediting Program, and we worked in the last couple years with our partners to refine the load estimation and tracking tools to kind of address some of the concerns that have been raised about the efficiency and some of the clunkiness of those tools, frankly. And again, we implemented a project that was really led by the implementers in terms of prioritizing where the money went and what improvements were the top of the list. Happy to say that that project is complete. The tools are functioning. Nothing is perfect. I'm not going to suggest to you that everything is absolutely ideal, but they are a lot better and things are working really well. And they're working so well at this point, again, that the permittees are now using that system to start to register their load reduction activities in the system and actually account for that stuff. And the permittees are all on track. I think that's the most important thing right now. Again, you guys, this board adopted a load reduction plans for all the jurisdictions, and those plans are being implemented. The load reductions needed to meet that 10% fine sediment particle load reduction are there, and we expect to see compliance with that. Just to share with you that I'm not kidding, and it's true, this is our credit accounting platform. I got a few screenshots of this. This is our homepage for that system. This allows Water Board staff as well as Nevada Division of Environmental Protection staff to review submitted materials, look at what is in the system, confirm that needed inspections have been performed, and then perform other tasks such as awarding credits and other things. So the system exists. There it is. And this is an example of a registration within that system. And I picked a good example here. This is Placer County's Kings Beach registration. Placer County prepared an extraordinarily detailed and complicated registration that is going to give them 252 credits. That is close to 90%+ of the load reduction they need for this permit term, simply from the actions that they've taken in King's Beach. The load reduction model for this is impressive in its complexity, but it is really well done, and they've done a really nice job of, again, kind of laying things out and documenting all the great work that they've done in that area to achieve load reductions within King's Beach. So this, again, is just an example of how the system looks and what we're doing. There are monitoring requirements as well. All of the load reduction credits that are awarded to local governments are taken from benefits expected from roadways and treatment BMPs. And so our monitoring focus is on that piece, the most important element of permit compliance. And that emphasis is on condition assessments, doing regular, consistent, and defined inspection practices of those roadways and treatment BMPs to confirm the conditions on the ground are consistent with the type of modeled estimates and what they said they were going to be doing when those credits were declared. The monitoring program also includes actual water quality monitoring. There's a detailed water quality monitoring element to the permit that helps us gather data to inform how the model is working for us. That model, again, the pollutant load reduction model, is our primary estimation tool. And by gathering data in the field, particularly at outfall status and trend sites and treatment BMP effectiveness sites, we can, one, determine overall if is the model giving us some reasonable numbers. And again, I don't want to suggest, as you said, things change on an annual basis. We can't tell year to year, but if we do some long-term status and trends data, we should start to see how well the model is performing against the actual on-the-ground data. And then the treatment BMP effectiveness, again, helps us understand how the treatment BMPs themselves are performing. And we're already using that data. The data that are coming out of there are showing that there may be some need to further evaluate how the model deals with those. And we'll be looking at that in the coming years in terms of evaluating what, if any, changes are needed to the model in response to this data. Permit update. The current permit expires in December 2016. It's amazing how fast 5 years flies. So we're looking to bring a permit to this board in early next year. When I developed this presentation, it was scheduled for January 2017. That may be February. We'll see how things go. It's going to be early next year. But initial coordination is already underway. We're having conversations with not only local government partners, elected officials, but as well as other stakeholders in the basin, including states like Tahoe, TRPA partners, and obviously coordinating with the Nevada side and the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection to make sure there's consistency in alignment. The good news is there's not a lot of change needed. The permit is serving us really well. We've put a lot of work into the last round, and at this time, we're not seeing any dramatic need for big changes in the permit. So we will be making some small tweaks, but for the most part, we'll be looking at adopting the permit, just implementing the next five-year load reduction target. That's that 21%, second star on the disturbingly linear line. We'll be looking at, that target as the next permit term. There also is a requirement for updated load reduction plans. The permit currently has those due in July. It is likely that date is not going to be met. There's local government is working on some different funding sources to actually do a coordinated effort to do some of that work, and we want to work with them to support that. And so we're looking at probably some of those load reduction plans. We will certainly keep the board informed as those come in. So I'll stop again. Is there any questions about the permit before I wrap up with some research and monitoring discussion?
Any questions? I have a question.
Great.
So in the outreach to the various groups in thinking about the permit update, have you included the basin fire chiefs?
Honestly, no. I haven't talked directly to the basin fire chiefs about how this permit influences their activities. I appreciate the suggestion. Through APC and through other avenues, we obviously engage with the fire chiefs on a variety of different things. And then Doug Fishman and Doug Smith with our office work with them on forestry issues. But I hadn't considered the potential overlap there, the potential engagement, and that's a great suggestion and an easy conversation to have. I'm not sure if that is something that concerns them or that they have interest in, but I'm happy to have that conversation with them.
Well, the reason I raise that question is that if there's an emergency, then all of this good planning goes out the window.
Of course. Yes.
And so back when I was on the Bi-State Blue Ribbon Commission, I did a lot of research about I tried to get a recommendation into that commission report that in the Tahoe Basin, a lot more outreach be done with property owners about the importance of being fire safe. And I found examples, you know, documented research of where those kinds of outreach programs were effective at reducing human-caused fire starts. And I tried to get the Blue Ribbon Commission to adopt that as a recommendation, and of course they weren't listening to anything coming out of a Lahontan person's mouth, so it did not get adopted. But
so now you like me to put it in the permit.
It's worth exploring.
Yes.
And you know, because that ounce of prevention,
yeah.
So that we don't get to where we hit an emergency situation. And with climate change and all, I mean, we're going to be having more fires in the basin. So the degree to which we can put energy into the preventive side.
Yeah.
So
so there are a couple comments on that. A great suggestion, a great discussion. The permit does have a residential component, and it requires some outreach and education and engagement with residential partners, and local government has the opportunity to get load reduction benefit from best management practice implementation at the local level, at the residential level. That said, our partners at Tahoe Regional Planning Agency also have a focus program for residential. So there's some tension there in terms of trying to make sure there's not redundancy and overlap.
Right.
And so, but what I'm hearing is there's an opportunity through stormwater management to increase not only the outreach and education, but also make sure there's not any overlap between what other folk, individuals are being asked to do with respect to BMPs and that type of requirement versus their stormwater management or their fire management and fire protection actions. So those are all fruitful conversations to have. I don't have any immediate answers for you right now, but I will open a dialogue with my local government partners first, frankly, because I know that they are interested in how this might look, and then also talk with the fire chiefs and see what opportunity there might be to, again, sort of leverage this a little bit and integrate it into the program in such a way that doesn't create any undue burden.
Yeah, the big clash on the Blue Ribbon Commission was the tension between the BMPs and the vegetation management.
Yes.
And
break it all up. No, we fell down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, bare ground. No, not bare ground.
Yes,
so what
yes,
is
exactly.
A homeowner to do? So I don't care who gives the message. There should just be a single message, and it
yeah.
should be effective. And you know.
And again, the fire chiefs at this point are really well funded with their outreach and education. There is really good messaging happening.
Okay.
And so again, I hesitate to say that there's an additional need there, but I see coordination that is possible. But again, there's a lot of good work happening in that realm. And again, I don't want to recreate that wheel, but there's an opportunity for us to support it. And more than anything, I want to make sure that we're not getting in the way.
Well, that plus, should an emergency or some sort of situation arise, the more communication up front and relationships you have built with the fire chiefs, the better the conversation will be through the emergency on the other side.
Couldn't agree more. Yes.
It's worth putting some energy in that direction, I think.
Agreed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The home stretch. Research and monitoring. I'm going to talk first about monitoring. Where am I? Yeah, there we are. So there's a lot of water quality monitoring that has been done and continues to be done in the Lake Tahoe Basin. It's being done primarily at three scales. That's a generalization, but those are the scales I'll focus on right now. We've been working, partnering with TRPA and UC Davis for more than 20 years now to collect water quality monitoring on the lake itself. Those long-term data sets were absolutely invaluable in developing the Lake Tahoe TMDL, and that relationship continues in terms of the funding for UC Davis to gather water quality monitoring on the lake. That said, there is a good conversation going on right now in terms of what are those data telling us, what are the best way to collect those data, and what's the best way to invest in water quality monitoring at the lake that is the most useful. So the agreements with UC Davis are coming due, and we've had a couple meetings now, coordinating meetings with TRPA and UC Davis, just to talk about that, and Davis is actually going to be coming up with some ideas about implementing the current system probably for the next year, and then looking again, are there any needed changes in what we're monitoring for what we're doing? We do a lot of work with bioassays, we do a lot of work with primary productivity, There's, of course, second measurements, there's nutrient measurements. There's a whole suite of things that are done. And again, there may be some efficiencies in how we do that work. Looking at tributary monitoring, again, there's a fantastic long-term data set there. The Lake Tahoe Interagency Monitoring Program has been operating for close to 30 years. And as with lake monitoring, those data were critical in developing the Tahoe TNBL. That effort is led by USGS. It has been funded by agencies over the years, primarily in the last decade or so by the U.S. Forest Service through the SNPHMA program. I'm happy to say that actually the Water Board is now helping to fund that program. We have resources available, and again, given our use of that information, the value of that information for our mission, I'm proud to say that we're participating in that program and providing some financial resources to do that tributary monitoring and continue that effort. Last is stormwater monitoring. The Tahoe Resource Conservation District heads up a program called the Regional Stormwater Monitoring Program to coordinate stormwater monitoring throughout the basin to make sure there isn't any overlap and redundancy, and the monitoring is done efficiently, effectively, and consistently across the basin. Right now, that program includes 8 catchment outfalls, so outfalls from directly to the lake, rather surface waters from urbanized catchments, as well as 3 BMP effectiveness sites. And the Regional Stormwater Monitoring Program is intimately paired with the stormwater monitoring requirements that I talked about for the permittees. So it is a good partnership between local government, our partner at RCD, and the Water Board, as well as other entities. There's funding in place right now, which is nice. Well, the Water Board helped fund further program development, again, to develop program structure. Who does what? What are guiding documents? What are sort of the adaptive management process? Those kind of things. So we've helped fund that, and we've also helped fund some monitoring. Those resources are in place for another year or so. And then there has been a round of federal funding that has been devoted, partner with local funding to extend this at least for the next few years. So we're always chasing money on this, but nonetheless, I'm happy to say that things are looking good right now, and we're able to continue the program. My desire right now is, again, we've established these outfall sites. As we talked about, we need long-term data. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years isn't really that helpful. I want to be able to gather outfall data for 10, 15 years to start to really say how things are looking. So, again, the Regional Stormwater Monitoring Program is a great step forward. This was a twinkle in folks' eye about a decade ago, and this is just great to see that it's happening and those data are being collected. So as for research, isn't that a great photo? As for research, our researcher at the Water Board with respect to Lake Tahoe has been focused on nearshore and continues to be. So I know Dan Sussman with our office talked with you over the last year about a nearshore monitoring program and our action plan, what's going on with respect to those pieces. So I just want to talk a little bit about where we are today and where that's going with nearshore monitoring. So as we move forward with nearshore monitoring and research, there's been a continued interest in this concept of key management questions. What are your key management questions? What are we trying to answer? It is a valid question. Unfortunately, for nearshore is extraordinarily diverse, and it is heterogeneous. It is different everywhere. It's very difficult for us to come up with some very pithy statements and questions about key management questions, given that diversity and given the complexity of the nearshore environment. A colleague of mine at TRPA, Dan Segan, developed this decision framework to kind of address that key management question push. I found it extraordinarily useful. I shared it with the board in an executive officer's report some time ago, and I just want to go through it again today just to give you a sense of how we're using this type of decision matrix to inform where we're going. This approach can be used for any, it can actually be used for any type of resource management question, but it also is really useful again for us given that we have 10 plus metrics of the near source. You can apply this to any of those metrics. At the top is this fundamental question. Is there evidence of change? Can we tell if something has been changing or not? Yes or no? If yes, do we understand what's causing that change? Do we know what the problem is? Oh, and if we do understand, great. Is there something that we as agencies can do about it? And if so, is what we're doing appropriate, or do we need to change? Again, and to me, that's a really nice rational decision process of how we look forward. More often than not, we're on the other side of, do we understand what's causing change? No, we don't. And so that leads us to the question of what do we do about that? What are our options for gathering that information? What type of research can we do? On the other hand, if there isn't any evidence of change, if we've been gathering monitoring data and it's not showing things are changing, it forces the question then is, are we monitoring the right things and are we doing it in the right way?
And if we are, if we're monitoring well, we're gathering good information, it's not showing change, we just need to more effectively communicate about what's going on. On the other hand, if we aren't monitoring the right things, then maybe we should reevaluate our monitoring approach. And that's some of what I just talked about with respect to the lake monitoring. So let's just run through this for periphyton. Periphyton is a attached algae in the near shore. We've been collecting periphyton data for close to 20 years at Lake Tahoe, so we have a little bit of data. And these are the 9 sites, and as you can see, the red ones show that there is increasing trends in 2 sites. So is there evidence of change? Yes. 2 sites. We know there's evidence of change there. Things break down pretty quickly because we don't know what's driving the change. But that's good, right? Because then we reach out to our academic partners and we reach out to other folks and say, what are our opportunities for gaining some insight? How can we learn what's causing the change here? And that has directly led us to a research project with USGS. So again, through that process of engaging with academic partners and other folks who are involved in this type of monitoring and research, we landed on a project to evaluate periphyton at Pineland in a very detailed study to look at and hopefully learn what's causing that change. And then, again, overlaying all of this is an ongoing effort to monitor and evaluate. We continue to kind of check back in with that. On the other hand, there are 9 sites here. 7 of those sites, there's no change, right? Or 6 of them, I think there's change, and 1 of them, there's actually a decreasing trend. So that pushes us to the other side of the decision tree of, are we monitoring the right thing here? Or are we doing it in the right way? And that's actually a very good question for us right now. I don't have an answer for you, but it is a clear and transparent inquiry that is front and center now with respect to periphyton. We've been having conversations with UC Davis and that they've been doing this data collection. Should we be monitoring different sites? Should we be monitoring transects rather than single sites? Should we reduce the number of sites in favor of transects? How should we go about this to see if we're adequately gathering the data to determine whether or not there's actual change? So, again, there's a possibility that things are good, that we actually are monitoring it well. Climate change, drought, a lot of the biological changes and complexities that you were discussing earlier. There's a lot of things going on in Lake Tahoe. There's some evidence that there has been massive periphyton blooms in the past dating back to the 60s. Maybe this is just normal, and we're seeing that there are just a lot more people in the lake. Lake Tahoe's visitation continues to increase. There are more and more folks around. Maybe we're just hearing more about people's concern about periphyton and that the condition actually hasn't changed that much. I'm not sure. Again, on the other hand, maybe we're not monitoring it the best. Maybe there are other ways we can look at this to better understand what the changes in periphyton might be. So I want to stress again, this is just an example of how we can do this for periphyton. There are 10 of these indicators, and so this is a tool that we can use across our nearshore research plan to help guide how we can look at the nearshore and start to answer the questions of what we can do about it. As far as summarizing the research, again, there's ongoing periphyton monitoring that we fund through UC Davis, and we're looking at that to determine whether or not there will be any changes. We also funded a series of pilot projects looking at community structure, looking at the composition, distribution, and looking at the biological resources, essentially. And those studies have given us an idea of the distribution of macroinvertebrates, fishes, crayfish, and macrophytes, plants in the lake. It's really nice data that helps us understand that question of, is there change? In most of these instances, there clearly is. So then we can start to ask the question of where do we want to go from there. We also funded, with our partners in Nevada, a pilot project to look at Lake Tahoe's the nearshore clarity. I'm driving around a turbidity sensor in the near shore looking at clarity there. So again, some really good information. The last rounds of turbidity assessment in the near shore found that it's not very turbid, generally less than 1. Certainly not busting standards, and certainly not anything to be terribly concerned about. The question then is are we doing this the right way? or are things looking pretty good there and we see some changes based on wave action and whatnot. So and the last one there, I mentioned we've got that hotspot study in periphyton in Pineland, looking at the periphyton and trying to understand what's going on there. Senate Bill 630 was adopted last year, 2 years ago, I think, at this point, and allocated the lease monies from state lands for the piers and buoys in Lake Tahoe to an account called the Lake Tahoe Science and Improvement Account. A portion of that is dedicated to the Water Board to evaluate nearshore conditions, do research and monitoring in the nearshore. I'm happy to say that in the last week, our budget change proposal for accessing those funds was approved, And so we have a pretty significant pot of money at this point to start to, again, invest in nearshore. And our first step right now is, again, working with our TRPA and other agency partners to develop what we call a nearshore resource allocation plan to help guide those investment decisions. And we're using, basing that on that on the framework that we just talked about, and coming up with some metrics of how we can start to make the best informed decisions to put our money in the right place and start to gather the most useful information. So stay tuned on that. Again, I think we're well positioned to start putting some money on the ground and answering some of these questions. Okay, my last slide. I just wanted to touch on some of the things that that myself and other members of the staff do to partner in Tahoe Basin with other agencies. Again, thanks to Steve DeShera for the kind words. Part of that role is with the TRPA Advisory Planning Commission. The first three of these is our TRPA, right? Tahoe Regional Planning Agency is the bi-state agency here in the basin that is mandated by Congress to protect this watershed. Their goals and our goals aren't that far off. Particularly with respect to water quality. So we have a long-term partnership with them. Their environmental improvement program is a critical part of restoration work in the basin. So again, that partnership is important, and so that's why we do so much with them. So as a part of that, again, on behalf of the executive officer, I sit on the Advisory Planning Commission, and as mentioned, I'm currently serving as the vice chair under the esteemed direction and leadership of our chair, Steve DeShera. I'm also working with TRPA staff and management on updating their shore zone ordinances. Their shore zone ordinances are 30 years old. There have been a number of attempts to address their shoreline ordinances in terms of how people access the lake itself with respect to buoys and piers and all that kind of stuff. Some of those efforts have been litigated. There's been a lot of controversy over the years, and this is the next push, and we're confident that this time around we're going to have some success. There's a lot of emphasis being placed on collaborative process and engaging with folks to make sure we don't sort of run into dead ends later. TRPA also has a mandate every 4 years to update their what they call their thresholds, the environmental indicators in the basin, and I'm working a little bit with their staff, particularly on the water quality elements, to gather what data and review those data to see how water quality thresholds are looking for TRPA. There is a nearshore agency working group. We partner with the US EPA, the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, and TRPA. Again, come together, talk about what we're doing for the nearshore. And so I'm currently serving with that group to help some of the nearshore questions. And then Mary Fury Wagner of our office has taken over some of Dan Sussman's previous work with respect to aquatic invasive species. She's helping out with the aquatic invasive species group. And then there's another side of those SB 630 monies for the science and improvement account and lake improvement account that is dedicated to the California Tahoe Conservancy for implementation in the nearshore. And she's sitting on a group, a stakeholder group there to help guide some of those resources. So again, we're trying to make sure there's some alignment and coordination there as well. So that's all I have today. My last brief for the day. I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Mr.
Dykes? Yes. Bob, I thought I heard you say earlier that warmer and drier conditions tend to promote improved lake clarity.
Yes.
But
why do we lose clarity?
But don't warmer conditions also promote algae growth?
They can. Absolutely. I don't disagree. It's certainly, and we saw that a lot of that in the past years of drought. We saw a lot of metahydrants, a large mass of free-floating algae in the nearshore. As the lake level gets lower, it gets warmer, and so some of those things are some of those elements of additional nutrients that are available because it's warmer, as well as warmer waters themselves, shallower water where light can penetrate. All of those things come together to increase the potential for algal growth.
Okay.
And there's also the issue that what Dr. Schledow keeps talking about is increased stratification of the lake,
yeah,
with warmer temperatures, which is going to make it harder to meet the clarity.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of talk of the potential catastrophic event that may occur if the lake does not continue to thoroughly mix.
Right.
So if the lake doesn't thoroughly mix, and as it stratifies, as you said, the waters in the deep part of the lake start to become anoxic, and nutrients could be released from that point. The lake hasn't mixed completely, I believe, in the last 3 years. Don't quote me on that, but I'm curious to see the latest data are not on that, but You're absolutely right. The warming conditions and stratification is another concern with respect to lake dynamics that certainly has some potential to impact our program. And again, through the TMDL management system, these are the type of things that we look at and we evaluate and determine whether or not those other conditions are influencing the TMDL as a whole and whether we need to respond.
Mr. Sandel, any questions?
No questions.
Thank you. So I have a question. Who is that on the calendar?
I don't know.
It's not you?
It's not me.
I'm very disappointed.
Not me. You know, we spend a fair amount of time on the lake on a paddle board. I have not ventured out with my dog. I don't know that she would do that well on a paddle board, but I see this a lot, and it is fantastic. I don't know who that is. I thought it was a very nice
okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that, at least with the near shore, there are lots of really interesting questions that to keep you busy for a while. I mean, the TMDL program is, you've got it all dialed down and it's boring. Well, then at least you have other questions to chase down. So.
I appreciate your support. Never fear, I'm not lacking for busy.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
And, Chairman's prerogative, I'm going to call for a 9-minute break. All right. We'll reconvene at 9. I know you all are just anxiously waiting for item number 10, but we have a speaker card on item number 9, and I'm going to allow Veronica to come up and say what she wishes to say. So, sorry for the backtracking.
Hello. My name is Veronica Wilson. I represent Caltrans. And I just have a couple comments on the Lake Tahoe TMDL, specifically the road ramp methodology that is used, the stakeholders use to verify compliance with the TMDL. So first of all, Caltrans is very concerned with safety. In order to complete a single road ramp observation, do you need me to, you know what road ramp is, okay? Okay, road ramp is the methodology is called, the ram is stands for rapid.
Just a second. Bob, I was supposed to call her up in the last item and I missed her, so I'm calling her back.
Sorry, I stepped outside, so I just heard road ramp and came back.
So it was my bad, but she has to talk. So.
No problem.
So just to define road ramp, correct me if I get anything wrong. RAM stands for rapid assessment methodology, and it's for the stakeholders to be able to go out into the road. Sweep the road, basically take samples of what's there on the road and then create a score, and that then generates our credits and meets our target, yeah. So we say we're going to meet a certain target, this just verifies that. So in order to complete a road ramp observation, Caltrans has to completely shut down our highway, and in order to do that, we have to then subcontract traffic control crew, and that is an additional cost to Caltrans to be in compliance. The whole round of program that we have to complete, just to do, we have to do multiple times per year, takes at least 2 to 3 days just for one round of road ram observations, and so it creates a lot of extra costs for us to have traffic control. Plus our consultants and our Caltrans on-site representative and all those people that need to be out there in the field, it just creates a lot of extra costs for Caltrans. And it also slows down that process because it does take additional time to set up traffic control and take down all the flagging and the cones for each location. So for Caltrans, for this period, we have at least 28 different sites that we have to verify our road ramp observations. So we have to set up and take down each site for traffic control. So it takes up around an hour for each location. So it just adds an additional amount of time and cost just for the traffic control. Additionally, we also have to submit lane closure requests to Caltrans Traffic Management Center. That's just to notify all the Caltrans crew, maintenance, and CHP that there's going to be work happening in our roads, the lane's going to be closed. That has to be submitted 1 week in advance to any lane, any closures. And so the coordination of advance notice for the lane closure request, coordination with our consultants, the subcontractors for traffic control, and the Caltrans representative, it's very difficult to coordinate and schedule a road ram date. And then throw in weather unpredictability. It's extremely difficult, and it takes multiple attempts just to get a road ram, you know, observation done. In addition, Caltrans is also very concerned about the correlation of road ram to the end of pipe discharge concentrations to Lake Tahoe. With Caltrans, our procedure is we, during a storm event, we put down our abrasives. Then after the storm event, as soon as possible, we sweep the roads, trying to recover as much sand as possible. We feel road ram is not accurately capturing that event where we're putting sand down at the time where it's most likely to be washed off the road. So we feel we should find a different approach to verifying our compliance to measuring what is actually being discharged from Caltrans roads into the lake. We would like to be a team player with this, so I just wanted to bring it to the board's attention that we have these concerns, and hopefully we can work together with the water board and find a better approach for saving Lake Tahoe.
So do you have any solutions?
We are working at this point. We are doing some studies on water quality, on monitoring, so we are collecting samples. And we also are doing verification studies of road ram. So at the same time that we are performing our road ram observations, we are also collecting samples to see if it is actually correlated. That study is going to be going on for a couple of years. So we're going to try and get those results before we can really propose anything. We really feel that our other methods that we've implemented so far, we have a cleaner sand that we are using, does not have the same fine sediment particles. And we also are more efficient at applying sand. We don't apply as much sand. We use the brine instead. And then we also are much more efficient with sweeping. So we sweep as soon as possible. We have a high-efficiency sweeper right now. We are looking into getting more sweepers. So we are constantly looking into improving our practices. However, we feel that at this point, the TMDL and our compliance is not accurately representing what we are actually doing to reduce the amount of fine sediments that are contributing to the clarity of Lake Tahoe.
Any questions?
Yeah, and I think Bob probably has to. Don't go away. I think, could somebody explain, first of all, exactly what the road ram procedure is? I don't think it's been mentioned today.
Yeah. I'm not going to explain exactly what the road ram procedure is. Just know that it is very detailed. Essentially, as Veronica indicated, it's an actual road observation. The intent of the rapid assessment methodology was to actually avoid the need and cost for water quality monitoring. I think this board is well aware of the costs associated with direct monitoring. And the challenges of stormwater monitoring are huge, and it's very difficult to get a signal. So the rapid assessment methodology was developed as a proxy, and so it was developed in partnership with the consultant team and our partners in our local government and Caltrans to come up with a way to look at a proxy measurement. So that proxy measurement looks at, as Veronica indicated, there's a visual observation on the ground that's looking at a high, medium, low deposition, and then you're essentially looking at those different areas in terms of the quality of that material. So you wet a finger and look at the moisture and the grit of it, essentially determine how much of it is fine. There's a dusting that looks at whether or not there's a dust cloud generated from those areas. There's an actual sample of the material to determine how much material that you can gather. So there's a suite of essentially physical observations there, a proxy. And some of that stuff sounds corny, and it is, and I know that this is a frustration of Caltrans, but at the same time, those things are correlated to more than 300-plus samples that were collected at the same time as those observations. And so this was done in a pretty rigorous manner to evaluate how those observations link to expected downstream water quality of that condition. And we've done a lot of sampling and a lot of verification of that approach over time. So I hope that answers your question with respect to that.
It makes me appreciate the carefulness with which the procedure was set up. But I can see that actually practically doing it
yes.
creates
yes, the practicality of it is
yeah.
a little difficult. And the other point to our argument is also that road ram is done when the road is dry, and after it's been swept. So for Caltrans, we are contributing at the point when it's, you know, wet.
But now the original observations that you used to show this was correlative, were those done when the road was dry and had been swept?
Yeah, the observations need to be done when they're dry just to get a better understanding.
But had the roadway been swept?
Not always.
Sweeping now.
So they were done in a variety of different conditions to get a range of scores. So it's a 1 through 5 score, with 5 being bad. So we've collected samples across a range of conditions. So I do want to make a couple comments here. I think I'm acutely aware and appreciate Caltrans' position. I'm also very grateful to the work that Caltrans has been doing. Caltrans has been a fantastic partner, and Caltrans has made dramatic strides in changing the way that they manage their roadways in response to this program. I'm sensitive to the fact that this has become a burden to Caltrans. The permit that we talked about during my presentation is echoed in the statewide permit for Caltrans. There's an opportunity for Caltrans to come up with alternative methods. So I appreciate the question in terms of what the solution might be. Then the Nevada Division of the Nevada Department of Transportation has a similar challenge, and they are working right now to develop what they call a highway ramp that is addressing some of these concerns. And so we continue to encourage Caltrans to participate in that effort. When RAM was developed and when the idea of doing these observations was first implemented, we wanted to have much more frequent observations. And it was a negotiation with the partners in terms of the frequency of those observations. So while I appreciate the comments in terms of we're not adequately capturing the conditions that are reflective of runoff, my response would be, well, we could do some more observations to actually collect those things and correlate them. And so, again, I guess I respectfully disagree that there isn't a relationship, because we've developed that relationship. It is documented. There are technical documents and reports on this. So that said, I've come beyond the point of arguing that with Caltrans. Again, I think we respectfully disagree on that at this point, and offer up the opportunity for Caltrans to come up with an alternative method that better suits their needs. As Veronica indicated, they are doing some paired sampling right now with water quality monitoring as well as riverine observations. They're also coordinating with NDOT to look at some of their work as well. So I think we're moving forward on this. I would like to say that we've cracked the nut and we've solved everybody's needs, but clearly Veronica making the trip up here is an indicator that we have work to do. So I'm just committed to doing that work and figuring that out.
One other question occurs to me is that I'm sure you guys have looked at this, but you are looking at how much sand has been applied,
yeah,
the exact quality of that sand,
yeah,
characterize that sand, and how much is swept up,
yeah,
and the characteristic of what's being swept up, and therefore what's left behind is the result of that subtraction.
There's so much variation winter to winter in terms of traction, abrasive application, and recovery. So you're right that we do there. The permits do require that all the jurisdictions, including Caltrans, report the type of material that they apply, how much they apply, how much they recover. And so we have that information. That information, again, is very difficult to evaluate. What I can tell you is over time, all jurisdictions are using less sand. That is good. The type of sand, as Ronnie indicated, has improved. And so we know that material has fewer fine particles. And so my response has always been that those improvements are evident in our RAM observations. Those things come out. Again, the disconnect between a wet road and the runoff and the overall and the observation that happens 2 weeks later when it's dry, it's a very real disconnect. That said, it's a proxy measurement. It is not an exact measurement. It is not an exact reflection. It is something that allows us to know that the activities and the maintenance practices that are being committed to are being done, and we have a way to verify that. Again, I said before, it's not perfect, and I have no doubt that we will come up with some solutions in terms of addressing Caltrans' needs. I will comment that compliance has a cost. And so again, Veronica's points are absolutely true, and I was in the line of traffic one day, like, what's going on here? Why are we stopped? Of course, they're doing RAM observations. So I was on the receiving end to some degree. There's a cost associated with that, but again, the alternative in terms of a representative stormwater quality monitoring system that would give us statistically valid data across Caltrans systems to know whether or not their loads are being reduced, that would be orders of magnitude more in cost, no doubt. And so, again, I think that the decisions in terms of where the investment is coming from Caltrans, certainly up to them, but again, I think this is actually intended to save jurisdictions money. I think it does, but I think there are improvements that we can make, again, to address the highway's concerns, because, again, NDOT has the same issue, and
frankly, these are just things that were not, did not come out for whatever reason when this was being developed. There were some concerns about safety, and then flaggers were brought out and things were good. But the realities that Veronica has brought up in terms of having to think so far out in advance, having to reserve the space, having to hire consultants, having, you know, all of that didn't actually start to come real until we got into this point where, as we talked about, the tools were improved, we got into a system, everybody started using them, and we're kind of, we're having to deal with it at this point. So the conversation we've had with Caltrans today is let's use the system, again, as frustrating as it might be, and look forward and look for ways that we can do that. And so, again, I'm really grateful for the work that Caltrans has done. I'm really grateful that you took the time to come up today and address the board, because it's an important conversation, and it's stuff that we need to figure out for sure.
Any other questions? Bob?
Yes.
Sorry if I misheard you.
That's
but
okay.
RAM is also embedded in the State Forest General Permit.
So this, yeah, so the State Forest General Permit essentially reflects our municipal permit, and so it requires Caltrans to use the Lake Clarity for Accrediting Program and its associated tools to document compliance. And so essentially by reference, it includes the pollutant reduction model and the rapid assessment methodologies.
I was trying to assess if this is a statewide problem or...
Sorry, no, it's explicitly for Tahoe, no. It's embedded in their permit for us. It is not something that is statewide. I apologize for that confusion, yes.
Thank you.
And I just want to raise this point. We talked about the fact that municipal permits expiring. The same target is coming due for Caltrans, and so I have initiated a dialogue with our state board staff to figure out how we can include the next target and, if necessary, include the additional changes in their permit as well.
Well, I would just like to say, I mean, I appreciate the frustrations on your side. There are always these things that have to be worked out when a new regulatory program is put in place, so it's par for the course, frankly. And my opinion is that given the importance of the Caltrans contribution to the problem of clarity in Lake Tahoe, you know, I mean, if you can come up with a better way to do it, great, but we simply have to know what, this simply has to be monitored. And, I mean, I trust both sides to keep talking and to figure out ways to improve this process, but we have to know what's going on out there. So if this is what the best you've come up with so far, then it just has to be done until you can come up with a better way to do it. That's my opinion. Anybody else?
I agree.
So that's the sentiment of the board.
Okay,
so
thank you.
Keep working on improvements.
Definitely will.
No doubt.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.